Good day, and welcome to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and as always, thanks for tuning in. It is spring in Washington, which means lawmakers are about to come back to a pretty busy agenda. President Joe Biden recently unveiled his $5.8 trillion budget proposal. It would increase taxes, some taxes, on billionaires. It would increase funding for police and gun violence prevention. And it would also implement parts of his Build Back Better agenda, which is stalled right now in Congress. The president would also increase defense spending, a request that divides his own allies in Congress. And, of course, the budget is just one of many priorities that members will face when they get back to Washington after their spring recess. Here to talk about everything that is going on in the nation's capital is Congresswoman Debbie Dingell, a Democrat who represents Michigan's 12th Congressional District. Debbie, welcome back to Detroit Today.
Stephen, it is always good to be with you. Happy almost Easter, Passover, in the middle of Ramadan.
Yes, that's right. And of course, this time of year also is a busy time for lawmakers, as I said in the open. Let's start with what your spending priorities look like this year. When you look at the president's budget, which are the items that that you want to push hardest for?
Well, there are a lot of things that we need to worry about. I think having talked to the White House and people connected to it and a lot of programs that I care about, you know, he tried to get his budget to reflect three things. Fiscal responsibility. Many people are worried about the debt and what the last few years have done. And so he tried to focus on that, but also safety and security at home and abroad. And then building a better America. You open talking about Build Back Better. There are a lot of things in there that I think we still need to be fighting for. Mm-hmm. I mean, what are my priorities right now? We should have done this a year ago. We live in Michigan. We've had trucks and automobiles sitting in parking lots because we don't have chips. We need to, one, get this COMPETES bill passed once and for all. And bring back the production of chips to this country. And then we need to help do what it takes to get companies to locate that chip production here. We stood at the White House a year ago, August, with the auto manufacturers, with all of the unions, and with all of the environmental groups, and set a target for 50% sales of zero emission vehicles by the year 2030. Well, we need to build. There are a lot of things we have to do to get there. Those vehicles have to be affordable. So how do we make sure that that's going to happen, incentivized while they're building up production? We need to invest in R&D so that we're building batteries with range. And we've got to mine those minerals here, create those minerals that'll be used here. We've got to upgrade our power grid and build out the infrastructure. And then last night we heard we saw a warning that we need to be, there is very real threats from Russia about the security again of our power grids. We've got to upgrade them and make them safe. That's another priority. And there are things like childcare and elder care. Too many seniors in this country don't have the option of staying in their own home as they get older, just need a little help. And everybody needs help. There are too many jobs open in this country, but we don't have good childcare. And I could keep going, Stephen.
Yeah. So I want to talk specifically about Build Back Better and how the president may be able to get some of those things done in the budget rather than getting them through Congress. First, let's start with where we are in Congress on negotiating that bill and the ideas in it. That was a very hot topic a few months ago, and it's kind of died down. I wonder if you can catch us up on that. But then also talk about the ability to go ahead, really, with some of these things because they're budgetary items.
Well, we've got to pay for them, and the president's budget had some things in there that would pay for it, like mm-hmm. a billionaire minimum income tax mm-hmm. and budget policies that would build on this and reduce. And by the way, his budget this year would have reduced the deficits by a total of over $1 trillion. You know, the other thing we look, inflation is real. And if you are filling your car at a grocery store, we all know it's real. I have seen it several days this week. It's scary. But we also have more people working. We've had more, the unemployment is the lowest it's been in more than 40 years. That is a good thing too. And people that are working are paying taxes, but we do need to fill the jobs that are empty. So that really matters. Build Back Better got caught up in a lot of politics and a lot of labels. I think there are quiet discussions that are going on, and it's not going to be as big a bill as was talked about last fall. I mean, it became in many ways a Christmas tree for everything. But there are very real things that we have to get done. I've talked to Joe Manchin. He and I do respect each other. We have very real and candid conversations. The White House does not, you know, sometimes, Stephen, neither national security, so when we talk about what we're doing for Ukraine, or as we are trying to just sit down and find common ground, don't have to be done on cable news shows or front page of newspapers. You need to bring people together and find out, okay, where is consensus? What do we have to get done? Where is the line too far? How do we get there? I think a lot of those quiet conversations are going on. There is a recognition that we have to do many of the things that were in that Build Back Better. And I'm hopeful that through quiet conversations, people are really trying to build together, we can get a consensus and get some of what's done in there.
I'm talking with Congresswoman Debbie Dingell. She's a Democrat from Dearborn who represents Michigan's 12th Congressional District. We're talking about all the things going on in Washington right now as members of Congress prepare to go back to work after the spring recess. There's a lot on the agenda, including President Biden's budget, several other items that we'll get to later in the conversation as well. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call and tell us what questions you have for Congresswoman Debbie Dingell. What do you think of President Joe Biden's spending priorities in his budget? What do you think specifically of his idea to impose a minimum tax on billionaires? That, of course, has gotten a wide range of reactions in Washington and all over the country. Also give us a sense of what you think you would like to see lawmakers in Washington focused on. As always, the number here on the phones is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to the WDET Facebook page and put the comments there, or you can go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we can work you into the conversation. Debbie, before we get to listeners, I want to talk about this billionaire tax, which I read a piece yesterday that said, this was by the Tax Foundation, so not fans of this idea. They said it would impose, it would add up to about a 61% tax on the wealth of high-earning taxpayers. That's probably a pretty grand exaggeration of what's going on. But make the case for, I guess, a minimum tax on billionaires. The numbers that the president is using is 20%. That's below what the average taxpayer pays anyway, but it's much more than many billionaires figure out how to pay. So does that make sense as a way to I guess get more people doing more of their share in the economy?
You know, Warren Buffett, many other billionaires say that they should be paying their fair share. They should be paying a minimum share. I believe 20%, or at least that's what's in the president's proposal, is closer than what should be there. And by the way, I know many of us are paying more than 20%. I just filed my taxes. Taxes pay for all the services that we want in this country. I will not tell you that at tax time, I'm a Seguinist. My husband used to think it was an honor to pay taxes. I was never quite where John Dingell was, but we do have a responsibility as citizens to to support our communities and pay for the services that we expect. And I believe billionaires have that moral and social responsibility, and they're very good at evading taxes. You know, you also look at corporations that are not paying any taxes, and we've given them tax incentives that have helped them locate overseas, et cetera. And I think everybody has a responsibility to pay their fair share of taxes. So I am not opposed to a minimum tax for billionaires. I think that that is fair. I think other Americans are paying their fair share at a far higher rate of what their income is. So no, I wasn't bothered by that at all, yeah. Stephen. And I think clearly people who don't want to pay their taxes, don't want to pay their fair share, spend a lot more money than I pay in taxes, avoiding paying taxes, have a responsibility.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. Let's start today with Jim in Southfield. Jim, welcome to the show.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. See, I just would like, as a Representative Dingell, to comment perhaps very briefly on House Bill 6698. She's a co-sponsor. It's essentially about ending Medicaid estate recovery. And if I could paint a brief picture, Dad has Alzheimer's, has to go to a nursing home. They cost $10,000 a month. They run out of money. The only program that will pay for the nursing home is Medicaid. And after Dad dies, Medicaid comes back and says, we don't care if Dad was a taxpayer for 75 years. We want our money back. Mm-hmm. Family has to sell the house, lose the family home. One other point I'd add in there is that Medicaid could save more if it allows people with Alzheimer's, dementias, to stay at assisted living instead of an expensive nursing home. And finally, it does tie into President Biden's Build Back Better. I mean, the ending of Medicaid estate recovery. Because families would have capital, and that way they could afford to go to community college, get that post-secondary education. So this seems to me, but the funny thing, end of rant, this bill is almost unnoticed. Hmm. And I hope Representative Dingell could comment.
Jim, so, I really appreciate the call. Go ahead, Debbie.
Yes, thanks, Jim, for the call. I don't have the bill right in front of me. I can tell you what I'm fighting for very strongly. Most people do not understand that Medicaid is the larger payer of long-term care in the country. And I have been working very hard through a number of different bills so that, like, one of the bills that I've introduced and successfully had passed the last few years, unfortunately, we're doing it year by year, and I would like to have it permanent, is the spousal impoverishment bill, where what you just talked about is that when someone gets Alzheimer's, someone that you're married to or gets some other form of debilitating illness, that in order to get the nursing care that you need or to get the care that you need, you have had to sell all of your assets to be eligible for Medicaid. And then it leaves the surviving spouse totally impoverished. And that is not the right thing to do. I've been trying to, and when I first heard this years ago, I couldn't believe it. I thought it wasn't the case. And this has become something that I have feel very strongly about and have been championing. Also in the Build Back Better bill is the long-term care bill that I have. Right now, Medicaid, which is the largest payer of long-term care in this country, is totally geared toward institutional care. It doesn't allow people to stay in their own home. It, quite frankly, is less expensive. In many cases, you don't need to have full-time care, but you need to have someone come in and help you with some, you know, basic check on your health, help you with dressing or whatever. And we're very much trying to there's been a very significant support for that, and I'd hoped that we were going to get that through, and I'm not giving up. I'm definitively pushing for that. And we do need to help people with Alzheimer's. They can be in assisted living facilities. So there are a multitude of bills. This is one, I can't remember the exact details because you're giving me the number here and I don't have it in front of me. But what we are trying to do is to help families and to help the individual. If you want to stay in your own home in the community that you know, and it's less expensive, we want you to be able to do that. This is something I'm passionate about. People do not know how broken the long-term care system is in this country,
yes.
unless you've had somebody that, you know, I was very lucky. John Dinkle was mentally alert and there every single second, but until he was in the hospital, and I am luckier than 99 and 9/10 of the people, and I would take my head and dash against the wall trying to navigate a broken system. You don't know how broken it is.
When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Congresswoman Debbie Dingell, and we're going to continue to hear from you on the phones and on social media. Bob in Macomb, Paul in Belleville, Anthony in Southwest Detroit, we'll get to you next. If you want to join them, 313-577-1019 is the number. You can also go to Facebook or to Twitter and put comments there, and we can try to include you into the program that way. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today. Listening to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and as always, thanks for tuning in. Our guest is Debbie Dingell, a Democrat from Dearborn who represents Michigan's 12th Congressional District. We're talking about all the things that are going on in Washington, but particularly the upcoming negotiations over President Biden's proposed budget. We want to hear from you as well during this conversation. Give us a call. Let us know what priorities you would set for the nation's spending. What do you think of this billionaire tax that President Biden has proposed? Is that a fair way to make sure that the wealthiest Americans pay a little more of their share in our economy? Also give us a sense of what things you might have in mind that you don't see in President Biden's budget. Some of the things that he's proposing to do would get Build Back Better, the legislation that is stalled in Congress, started with some money. Are you in favor of that? Do you think that's a good way to get at those issues? As always, the number on the phones here is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to the WDET Facebook page or to Twitter and leave your comments there. We'll start today with Paul in Belleville. Paul, welcome
to
the show.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, hey, go ahead.
Yeah, my question is, the Big Build Back Better bill is huge, and people don't know what's inside of it. Why not break the bill apart in the individual parts, and then we can see where various Republicans and Democrats stand on specific issues, and it also will give more information to the public about what's in the bill.
Paul, great question. Debbie, why not think about chunking this up, I guess, and moving it through separately?
So this is one of the challenges of the United States Congress and where we are right now. I do believe that everybody should have a much clearer picture of what is in this bill. It will clearly be smaller than what was discussed last fall.
Mm-hmm.
But you can only use the process by which this bill is considered a couple of times a year. And it's a budget process called reconciliation. And as most of you know, we have a 50-50 Senate. And in order to get almost anything passed, you need 60 votes. And you also have a system in the Senate where one senator can put a hold on a bill, and the senators don't force things through. The Senate is where things go to die far too often, and I'm just going to be candid about that, and it deeply disturbs me. Reconciliation only requires 50 votes, but you can't use it. It was a number of years ago, before I was in Congress, I believe Senator Byrd was still there. It was a process by which they put in place to get budgets through so that you could not stop it the way that so many other pieces of legislation are through, because we do need to fund our government. I would prefer to do it the way you are talking about, quite frankly, I'd prefer to be doing CHIPS that I talked about earlier. Why we couldn't just do CHIPS instead of having to do a huge bill, and we're not doing that under reconciliation, I believe should have been done as well. People like me continue to push for some things that you're talking about. I get in trouble. I'm in trouble with my leadership right now because when we did the omnibus spending bill, they tried to penalize a number of the Midwest states when California and New York and the bigger states had been taken care of, when they were going to take some of our money away from the American Recovery Plan when those states had gotten 100% of theirs. But you have to be very detail oriented, and I caught it in the middle of the night and flagged it for other people. And trust me, my leadership's been pretty mad at me for a month. I think it's far better for the country when we are able to make sure, and I try very hard to make sure when I'm voting on big pieces of legislation, people know what's in it and to share it with other people. But it is, if we want to get this done, we have to use the reconciliation process, and that cannot be done breaking up this bill into different parts.
Yeah, yeah. Paul, appreciate the call and the questions. Let's go to Bob in Macomb. Bob, welcome to the show.
So I wanted to talk about the fair share part of the discussion. It seems to me, my understanding is the government takes about $3 trillion from the taxpayers every year, rough numbers, and about $1.5 trillion of that comes from the top 10%, and about $900 billion comes from the top 1%. So when we talk about fair share, the top 10% pays about half of all the taxes the government collects, and the top 1%, which is these billionaires, pays about a third, 33% of all of the taxes collected. So I get they're only paying 20% of their income, 18% of their income, 15% of their income, but it's a third of everything the government takes. The bottom 90% pays a third. The top 1% pays a third. It really seems to me that's pretty fair. I mean, even more than fair.
Should
1% of the people pay 1% of the taxes? And you know what I'm saying? I mean, it's disproportionate because of the way the income is set up, but it really seems like taxing that group more. And the other piece of it is that the income tax amendment said that you could tax income. You can't tax stuff that isn't income yet. I think you're going to have a big problem with the Supreme Court with that bill.
Very interesting point, yeah. Bob. You're talking about the unrealized gains part of the tax package. It's an interesting way to frame it, Bob, right? How much money is coming in and who's accounting for that money, as opposed to looking at people as individuals and saying, you know, who's paying what percent of what they have, which I think those are different fairness questions, no question about that. But Debbie, I wonder what you make of the way that Bob is framing this and saying, look, you know, wealthy people already pull a lot out of their pockets to fund government. Why isn't that fair?
Look, I believe in the free market system. I do know I need to, I don't have all the figures in front of me, Bob. I'm going to go look for those numbers and look at all of them. And obviously this was a proposal the president proposed. We will have hearings and in-depth discussions, but some of those billionaires aren't paying any taxes. And I don't think that's fair either. And you look at how they've gained their wealth and at the expense of who they've done it with. And some of them have some questionable business practice. Some of them are very, you know, Warren Buffett is someone who I admire a great deal and is a person that says they should be doing this. So I want to study the issue more. I think, though, of those who have more have a responsibility to pay more, quite frankly. But those are fair questions, and I think it should be on their income. You can't. I think we need to have, the president has proposed it. We will have hearings. We will see where this goes. But I do believe that people do have their wealth is far greater. Their income is far greater. And by the way, they're making it at the expense of a lot of Americans who are really still struggling. So I do believe they've got a responsibility to pay their fair share on their income and not hide it with different tax tricks that have and dodge some of their responsibilities either.
Well, and I think there is something kind of intrinsically important about the idea of every person contributing in a fair way to the republic, right? The idea that if you, the wealthier you are, the lower your percentage is a fundamental unfairness. I mean, the idea that poor people end up paying a higher percentage, or middle class people especially, pay a much higher percentage of what they have than the wealthy people. I mean, that is the way we think of these things. It is not about what the total amount of money is coming in to government. I would also make the point that if everybody were paying at the same rate, government would have a lot more money. And some of the things that we talk about not being able to do, not being able to care for young people, not being able to care for the elderly, not being able to provide health insurance for people who can't afford it, those things would be more possible if you had more money going into government. And the way to get that there is to ask the people at the top to pay more of the share that that everybody else does. Bob, again, thanks very much for the call and the questions. Let's go to Anthony in Southwest Detroit. Anthony, what's on your mind?
Hey, good morning. You know, I saw Representative Dingell did an interview 2 weeks ago on WEMU, and they asked, are you going to vote for the defense spending, or don't you think we have a military-industrial complex that's gone awry? And I don't know. It seems, Representative Dingell, it seems like you wanted to, you're going to vote for this defense spending. You've already made your mind. It's almost $1 trillion. Every program you're talking about here, it sounds penny-wise and pound-foolish to me.
Anthony, great question. We have not talked about the defense part of the president's bill. Debbie, give us a sense of what you think of it and whether you have made up your mind to vote for it.
So, Anthony, again, we are at the beginning of the appropriation process where there will be hearings. People will look at what the expenditures are. But I am going to tell you, we are at a very scary time in terms of our national security and what is happening in the world. The Putin's invasion of Ukraine, what it is doing to potentially threaten the world order is very concerning. And I want to make sure that the United States of America is safe. We do need to hold the defense establishment accountable, look at how their money is being spent, make sure it's not being wasted. And I have a long history of doing that. But quite frankly, keeping our country safe, investing in ways for our national security is not only the traditional ways that we think of it in terms of the ships and missiles and et cetera, but the warning last night about Russia potentially triggering cybersecurity efforts to bring down our grid or to potentially actually do physical damage. It could potentially kill some people at energy plants. Should worry us, and we need to ensure that we are protecting ourselves in ways, non-traditional ways. So I'm not, when I say, I am not somebody who says, oh, I'm anti this. I believe we need to keep our country safe. I also believe that we are, both the Defense Department and the State Department need to be accountable to the Congress. We need to do very strong and stringent oversight of how expenditures are being spent and hold them accountable. But anybody who thinks that we are living in a time of peace, it's what we all want. It's what, but that, keeping that peace means that we need to be prepared, because being prepared makes people know that we are not weak and vulnerable. And we have China, North Korea, Iran, Russia, many people, Saudi Arabia, countries around the world that want to bring the United States down. So I want us to work with our allies. I do not think we should be working alone. We need to be working alongside many of our friends around the world for peace. I do not want to see boots on the ground in Ukraine. That if we were to go to war with Russia directly, the devastating consequences of that, I really had hoped that nuclear war was something that our children weren't going to have to think about, and it's back on the table. So you cannot disarm ourselves. We have to be responsible. We have to hold them accountable, and we have to be prepared.
So, Debbie, before I let you go, I want to change the subject just a little and talk about your support for legalizing marijuana at the federal level. It's something that hasn't gotten a lot of attention, but tell us why you support that.
Well, I mean, I'm going to be very candid because you know that I am when I get in trouble for it. But I am a family that has been very much impacted by drugs. My father was a drug addict, and my sister died of a drug overdose. So I have a very healthy respect for what drugs can do and how they can destroy families and destroy people. But legalizing marijuana was on the ballot in Michigan a number of years ago. The people of Michigan wanted it legalized, and it has been legalized. But there are two things right now that we cannot do that we need to be able to do. So we are seeing marijuana stores open around different kinds of businesses open around Michigan. And those business owners cannot go to a bank and deal with a bank. Mm-hmm. They are walking around with canvas bags of cash. It's dangerous. It's not good for anybody. And we need to have a banking system that recognizes this is a form of business that's been legitimized. On top, more than that, but it's one reason, we are not doing the research that we need to be doing to understand the impacts of marijuana on children, medicinal purposes, what driving. And that is because right now at the federal level, this is categorized as a level one drug. So researchers cannot even get, there's one place that they can get any access to marijuana, which is the University of Mississippi. It's only one form. We need to really be doing the R&D on this subject. And we need to allow people to have access to the drug so that we all know what it is showing. Do we need to worry about what the impact is in our children? Is it, can, does it have medicinal purposes? What does it mean when you're driving and stoned? All of those things we need the facts on, and that can only happen if we, this legislation that we passed at the federal level, it would allow it to be moved to category two and much more needed research to be done. And three, quite frankly, in this country, we are a patchwork of states, 50 states and a number of non-voting regions. You can't have a patchwork of laws on these kinds of things. We need to act. We need to do something. The people in many states are speaking and making, they've voted, they want it legalized. Sure. Our federal government needs to catch up.
Yeah. Yeah. Those are all compelling arguments. Okay. Debbie Dingell, always great to catch up with you here on Detroit Today. Always great to hear what you're up to in Washington. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Be safe.
When we come back, we are going to talk about the Midwest Literary Walk in Chelsea, which is back. Next on Detroit Today, I'm going to talk with one of the featured writers at this year's event, Don Winslow, about his new book, City on Fire. Stay with us for more Detroit Today.